Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Wednesday, June 24th, 57 degrees here in Old Town Park City. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's Erica Martin. Good morning.
Good morning. So we do have a pretty nice day in the forecast. Mostly sunny skies, but clouds developing for the second half of the day. Modeling right now does indicate that the cloud coverage will come in, I'd say, right around midday. And there is that possibility of those isolated showers. So we're going to get those in the forecast for Park City today and to throw some isolated thunderstorms. Again, very isolated. There's a cold front that's going to sag on down. Additionally, we have the associated troughs. So just unstable out there. But I certainly want to make sure that everybody understands that, especially if you are planning on doing some kind of outdoor activity. So the expected high for today in the low 80s. Overnight lows are going to be pretty warm. We're going to see upper 50s. And on Thursday, tomorrow, we're going to continue to see some isolated showers out there. And temperatures are going to dip just a bit into the upper 70s. So 77 is your expected high temperature. And then Thursday night, we're going to drop into the lows. Will be in the upper 40s. 49 is your expected overnight low. On Friday, we will keep it in the upper 70s, mid to upper 70s at 76 degrees. But very nice. Now, I'm adding clouds because one of the models is actually indicating an increase in cloud coverage late Friday. So we're going to go from mostly sunny to partly cloudy skies for the second half of your Friday. For this upcoming weekend, we climb again with a high of 84 degrees on Saturday, and then we're keeping it at 81 on Sunday, increasing cloud coverage on Sunday, increasing wind speeds on Sunday. And it looks like we could see some fire weather concerns, really dry conditions and low relative humidity and very strong wind speeds and wind gusts. We kick off the next work week with a chance of some showers. But overall, I think it's a nice stretch of weather. We still have that area of high pressure that's our dominant weather maker, but certainly worth noting for any outdoor activities to just be aware of your surroundings and that we do have that possibility for some isolated pop-up thunderstorms this afternoon.
Okay, thanks, Erica. KPCW News Time now, 8:08. Good morning. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be talking with Basin Recreation Trails and Open Space Manager Matt Wagner with a follow-up from last week's trail etiquette discussion. Park City Manager Matt Dias with a preview of the agenda for Thursday's City Council meeting. And finally, Deer Valley Marketing Director Colleen Reardon with details about this weekend's opening of the summer season there. Stay tuned. Taking a look first at local news now, the Park City Board of Education abruptly terminated all salary negotiations earlier this month in anticipation of deep budget cuts to the state education funding. However, the Utah legislature, meeting in a special session last week, preserved a 1.8% increase in school funding. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has this up update on negotiations now moving forward.
In May, school districts throughout the state were asked to plan for scenarios that would cut up to 10% of the 2021 school budgets. Due to the economic downturn in tax revenues caused by COVID-19 shutdowns, the Park City School District approved the 2021 budget last week, reflecting the requested 10% reductions. It passed unanimously. Now that the legislature has approved a 1.8% increase to school funding, negotiations will resume. Park City Education Association co-president Julie Hooker is hopeful that the revised budget targets will allow compensation discussions to restart. She says teachers had to work 24/7 to support students while transitioning overnight to virtual learning.
You know, the hope is to be fair and equitable across the board to make sure that we can still attract and retain the highest quality teachers. You know, there was some frustration from teachers after what they had done to support distance learning. You know, our teachers flipped on a dime and were presenting curriculum electronically in a day.
Hooker anticipates teachers at all levels, especially in the elementary grades, will have to develop individual learning plans for many students after 6 months of being out of the classroom. She says Park City has a history of good faith bargaining and hopes that they'll have a contract by the time school resumes in August.
So what are we going to go back in and solve? I applaud Todd Hauber for his effort to find where we can make cuts. Well, the Park City Education Association wants to be a part of that. We want to look at what do we really need for the success of our students.
Carol Lear is the Utah State Board member representing Park City and Salt Lake City. She says the 1.8% increase to the WPU is better than they expected, but only covers the cost of inflation.
But 1.8 increase to the WPU is really not enough to fund teacher salary increases, because I think the number is about 2.2 that just barely covers steps and lanes and increases to insurance and things like that. So I don't think there'll be increases to salaries this year.
Lear says the most flexible funding school districts get is in the WPU. It funds most of their employment and student costs. There are some special programs the legislature singles out for specific funding, such as additional school counselors, mental health workers, nurses, or IT programs.
What the legislature is saying, oh, you didn't get cut. We absolutely did get cut from what we expected to get last January. We just didn't get cut below how we were funded. In fact, we still had a little bit of an increase from the previous year.
She says $13 million was cut for overall administrative budgets, which are principals, superintendents, and other administrative leaders. Increase to the school budget would require a public hearing. The next Park City School Board meeting is scheduled for August 18th. I'm Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
It's 8:13 now. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, last week, Summit County Mountain Trails Foundation and Basin Rec hosted a discussion on trails etiquette. As trails continue to gain popularity, complaints of overcrowding and parking at trailheads are increasing. On the phone with a follow-up to that discussion about what happens next is Matt Wagner. He is the Trails and Open Space Manager for Basin Recreation. Good morning, Matt.
Morning, Leslie.
So it sounds like you had a pretty good discussion. What was your takeaway from Basin Rec's perspective?
Yeah, I think it was a good discussion, and I was really impressed with the turnout. I think all told we had close to 100 participants, and I thought that everyone's attitude was very constructive. So I was appreciative that they were able to come to the table with some solutions. The conversation was good. We certainly have heard a lot of the issues that were raised before, and I think it gave us some direction and really will allow us to start working towards implementing and understanding the feasibility of those solutions.
All right. Well, many of the trails are on public property. Several, however, are also granted easements on private property. Are we at risk of losing those easements? If things don't change, I guess, is what, yeah.
I think that's, if it's a possibility, it's a very slim possibility. Those are easements are fairly well protected by development agreements and the way that they were granted. So we're really motivated to do everything we can to address these problems and mitigate some of the issues that have been identified. And so I think that as that is a possibility that people talk about or think about far down the line, I think there's, you know, a lot of little things that we can do to get started on the issues before that even becomes a possibility.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of those common complaints and some possible solutions. As we said, trailhead parking congested and it's impacting neighborhoods. What do we do about that?
So I think parking is a real common issue, and it's something that we know how to solve, but it's just a matter of logistics and resources. So one of the categories that I sort of lumped these solutions into was transportation. And that's really just about getting people to trails while creating less traffic and parking congestion. And we certainly have the knowledge of how that gets done. But it's really just about collaboration. And we're just a recreation district, so we're really relying on partners to be able to implement some of these solutions. And, you know, with the sort of multi-agency, multi-department collaborations we're talking about, those wheels grind kind of slowly, but we're getting the process started now. So hopefully transportation is one thing that can impact those issues. Dispersal is another one where we have a large system. There are many access points. We have a few very popular hotspots. So understanding what makes those areas specifically so popular, and then how we can make access points better everywhere. So not trying to be punitive or restrictive, but just making it better everywhere so that there's not use concentrated in one specific area.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about transportation. I mean, I understand that that's not your, that's right. That falls under somebody else's job. But that right now the transit system is pretty anemic. So, I mean, it's not going to happen this year. Are we just talking about future years? And, of course, it's anemic because of just the situation we're in with the COVID-19.
Right. Yeah. And there's a lot of challenges that throws into these strategies that, and this process started before the restrictions related to COVID-19. So we've been talking about implementing some of these solutions. And the process got delayed, especially the public process. But yeah, it's definitely going to create some challenges. But what we're thinking about can also be quite simple solutions, like making it easier for people to walk or bike to their favorite trailhead, creating more neighborhood connections, allowing residents who live in a certain neighborhood to be able to get to a trailhead without necessarily driving there, and creating more parking congestion, but also something as simple as putting bike racks at trailheads. And you might not want to drive to a trailhead, but you could easily bike there and then hike from that point. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a big and expensive thing. I know a lot of the transportation options are, but like a dedicated recreation shuttle or enhancing the transit system we have now. But it could also just be something quite simple as trying to encourage people to use active transportation as much as possible.
Right. And there's been a real popularity in bikes on the Silver Lake and Empire bus routes in past summers. But the problem there is that they're limited to six bikes. So, I mean, how do you solve that issue? Just by designated bike buses?
I think that's part of the solution. Again, I've seen this work in other areas, but it's not necessarily, and this came up in the discussion last week, in that, you know, we're not necessarily an apples-to-apples comparison with other transit systems, but mm-hmm. I've seen it work in other places where you can potentially remove some seating and add some space for bikes to create something that is more of a dedicated recreation shuttle. But those are, seasonal, maybe only on weekends, and they are also pretty resource intensive. So, like you mentioned, we have a lot of limitations right now that we're trying to work through. But I think transportation is one of those things that can just really directly address the, especially parking congestion issue.
Yeah. And there's also been some talk about giving residents perhaps trailhead parking passes, but there seems to be a reluctance to do that. I mean, we've heard that it works well in other communities. Why wouldn't we want to at least try that here?
I think permitted parking is certainly an option that we've looked into extensively, and it's still on the table. And of course, as trying to be supportive of taxpaying residents, we would want to find some way to make trail access easier for folks who are already supporting the trail system. But that's another one that just requires a lot of cross-department collaboration. Because there is so much public right-of-way parking available close to so many of our trailheads, that it would probably require some sort of neighborhood permitting of the streets as well, and also the resources that are necessary for managing a parking system. Because we have so few stalls that we can actually permit and charge for, it becomes more of an expense than a revenue generator. So those are logistical issues that we're looking into right now, and but it's something that we don't see necessarily as a money-making venture. It's just something that we can use to potentially control some of that trailhead congestion.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about dogs. I know that was also another issue discussed. Just the off-leash dogs, or the dog leash regulations not being followed, and people not mm-hmm. cleaning up after themselves. I don't know how you teach people to be better people, but what do you do about it?
Yeah, and those are big behavioral kind of cultural shifts that need to happen. And I think that's been sort of an underlying discussion of this whole process, is that we can do all these things to address parking and trail congestion and try to get people separated, but that's just kind of sidestepping the issue of people just need to behave and share more kindly on the trail. So that's sort of come up again and again, is that really a courtesy campaign, some new signage, some presence at the trailheads with trail ambassadors. And those are all sort of short of increasing our enforcement capacity, which is another one of those multi-agency collaborative efforts. But, you know, we really think that that has to happen no matter what, that we really have to address behavior and etiquette and try to get people to share the trails more respectfully, because there's not going to be fewer people using the trails. Growth is only going to continue in popularity.
Yeah. Also brought up were just the bikers blasting past hikers. Have we come to the point where we need to segregate trails?
Well, we certainly do that in the system already. We have some dedicated, especially downhill directional mountain bike trails. I think it's becoming more and more common across the trails industry is that, especially in popular systems, that you create single user trails. I think, again, that gets back to the issue of behavior and etiquette on trails, in that to really accommodate everybody equitably, then we don't have the resources to build a whole separate trail system for bikers and a whole separate trail system for hikers. So there's always going to be multi-use and shared trails. And so in that situation, there's always going to be the need for people to just behave respectfully and understand that other people are using the trails and at separate speeds.
Yeah, there was some talk about trail ambassadors and some sort of trail ranger solutions. Mm-hmm. That, again, I guess that's an expense, though, right? I mean, we've got to pay for that person, or is it a volunteer job? Or
trail ambassadors, the way that I envision it, and we already have a trail ambassador program, but I think it could be expanded and improved upon, and as does Mountain Trails Foundation. But that would be a volunteer position, and again, that's kind of, people sometimes are more receptive to education and outreach from their peers as opposed to having somebody in a uniform with a badge to chat with. But so that also, I think there's sort of a misconception as well that volunteer labor is free. It's actually quite expensive to manage and coordinate volunteer efforts, so that certainly would require some more staffing and some more resources. And then, of course, a code enforcement officer or something that we would call like a trail ranger or somebody who's working on those parking and behavior issues, that's all. That would be a whole new position, something that our staff might be able to step in and do in the short term. But if we really want to dedicate and make some progress on these issues, I think we have to have some full-time staff. So again, that's more resources and maybe farther down the road than a volunteer effort.
Yeah. We don't do this here yet, but we certainly see it along the Wasatch Front Canyons about kind of dogs only on certain dates. Is there talk about doing that here?
We have talked about that, maybe not specifically as much for dogs, but for user groups. So we've considered options for separating bikers and hikers on certain days, or creating directional trails that are only effective on alternating days, things like that. And that's a strategy that's discussed in the presentation as well as something that I would call time partitioning. But again, a lot of those solutions are, if you're going to be switching regulations, you really have to be on top of outreach and education. Signage has to be really good, and most of all, you have to have an enforcement presence so that people actually follow those rules.
So what happens from here, and when do you expect we could actually see some changes or improvements?
So there's some, at the end of the meeting last week, there was some suggestion that there should be a Summit County Council work session, and I think that's being scheduled for next month. So that's where we're hoping to really dig into these strategies and prioritize them and really understand what the obstacles are to implementation. I think because we have such a range of options, some of them quite small in scale and some of them much larger, there are some smaller things that could be implemented in the short term. And one of them being something that I'm really excited about and something that we were fortunate enough to get some funding from the Summit County Restaurant Tax Grant Program is a trail counter system. So some permanent trail counters at trailheads that are going to help us really get some baseline data and understand how the trails are being used and when they're being used. And by the system that we'd like to install is can also differentiate between types of users. So it'll detect bikes versus hikers. I don't think anything can detect dogs versus hikers yet. But yeah, so we're really excited to just get some baseline data, and then we'll be able to understand how these changes are impacting how the trails are used.
So is that something like UDOT uses on the roads, some kind of electronic measuring?
So it's a combination of like a laser or actually an infrared sensor that detects people passing across the sensor, and then it's also an inductive loop system, so it'll detect a bicycle that moves over it. So that actually we are planning to install this year and have at least some initial data from the end of this dry season, and then we'll get a full year of data next year as well. So that's something that's going to be implemented very soon that will help us make some of these decisions.
Okay. Hey, Matt, anything else you wanted to mention?
No. Thank you for the opportunity, Leslie.
All right. Thank you. Matt Wagner is the Trails and Open Space Manager for Basin Recreation. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. It's 8:28. It's 8:29 on this Wednesday morning. We've got 59 degrees already here in Old Town Park City. Again, looking for mostly sunny skies today with a high of about 82. Well, the Park City Council meets in work session starting at 4:30 tomorrow via Zoom. On the phone with a preview, Park City Manager Matt Dice. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Leslie.
First up, a discussion on rooftop solar for a couple of city buildings, the public work offices, public works offices, and then the Quinns Water Treatment Plant. So these are capital projects, I guess. Didn't we try and cut capital projects to given the decreased revenues?
Excuse me, we did moving forward. These are two recently or about to be completed projects. So these projects have been worked on for the last several years. And City Council wants to make a determination each time we're bringing a new project on board about how to treat our net zero and energy goals. So for the benefit of the public, we have a new facility over kind of in the middle or adjacent to the driving range. And we've also renovated one of our bus barns to accommodate some office space. And so both of those facilities will now be kind of called to question about how to treat them and the net zero goals that we have. I think the silver lining here is, you know, we did proactively build them out as well as we could to be very, very sustainable. So each facility, you know, for example, would consume approximately 40% less energy than it would have otherwise had we not been, you know, LEED certified and very progressive a few years ago in our planning.
Okay, so we're moving forward. You're saying that the solar panels are already installed?
No, that's the question that City Council will be able to buy RECs or invest in a solar farm off-site or put solar panels on these facilities. So it's really to call that question about how they wish to continue the net zero aspect of these facilities going forward.
Okay, let's see, at 5 o'clock, a summer special event discussion. We've seen cancellations of a couple of the biggest events of the year, the 4th of July Parade, the Kimball Arts Festival. What else are we looking at?
Well, we're looking at a lot of different things. And just to take a step back, you know, this is a difficult balance that we're trying to strike here as a community. You know, obviously our priority is the health and wellness and safety of our residents and visitors, but we're also very, very aware that we're trying to be extremely supportive of jobs and economic recovery, and events are a large component of that, and the kind of vertical integration of all the jobs and service industries that go into our events really runs the gamut and is significant. So we felt it was time to, you know, kind of come in and talk with council, have a public forum. The idea is to try to make an informed policy decision moving forward. We'll be bringing in stakeholders from the chamber and the lodging and the restaurant industries. We'll be bringing in the health experts from Summit County and trying to seek a bunch of public input about how the community wants us to handle events going forward. You know, we have some large events from soccer tournaments and lacrosse tournaments to even some of our civic and cultural events from Miner's Day and Autumn Aloft and Shot Skis. And so We need to make a determination about how we're going to handle gatherings moving forward. And clearly our elected body has the authority to move beyond the state guidelines. You know, just because the state guidelines allow a certain threshold, we could always be more restrictive if we felt it was in our community's best interest.
Oh, we can do that. We don't need state approval?
Not necessarily. I mean, we are, for a lot of these events, we're the event permittee. So we're the entity that's allowing the event to happen. We're either using our rights of way or we have contractual agreements with the event organizers. And so to the extent that those are no longer in our interest or we don't think that we want those activities here, we could absolutely shift. We could absolutely augment. And so you'll probably see staff have that discussion that they feel, you know, our special event staff works really, really closely with all sorts of event organizers in the service industry. They feel that a lot of these events can happen safely and within the guidelines. But there are some events in particular that are large and create large gatherings. We've talked about the 4th of July for and others that will, you know, will likely have to be changed.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what is it that the city could do? I mean, could you require people wear masks to attend these events?
We could. We absolutely could. We could not allow certain aspects of the event. You know, for example, our 4th of July proposal that's in the work session for Thursday, recommends no parade. That's a mass gathering. It brings in thousands of people from outside of our community and forces them into a relatively congested area. And it's kind of a sad day that sort of cultural event might not have that parade, but we think that's in the community's best interest. I mean, conversely, there are all sorts of additional constraints or restraints that the city council could put on soccer tournaments or lacrosse tournaments and other kind of cultural events throughout our community.
All right. So right now it sounds like we're going to go for a car-free Saturday and Sunday for July 4th and July 5th.
It did. It just seems sort of easier, that being a holiday weekend, instead of putting things in and taking things out, to just sort of have better continuity and flow throughout the weekend. We have sort of surveyed the business district on Main Street, and I think overwhelmingly they were supportive with a kind of consistent approach, and we've had some success. I think, I think by and large, the initial reports from the Car Free Sundays is they've been positive. People have been safe. We've been having lots of staff and other types of city officials out in the street handing out masks and sanitizer and additional signage. And so, again, we're just trying to strike that balance of safety and health and trying to support economic recovery.
All right. So no parade, but it sounds like there will be a public fireworks show?
That's the hope right now. We're calling it the moniker lately sort of a locals 4th of July, a true locals 4th of July, where we are not advertising down in the valley or otherwise. And we think it could be a neat capstone to the weekend to work with our partner at Park City Mountain, send fireworks up in the air, and people can be in their neighborhoods with their neighbors or with their friends or with their family and watch them from their homes or their cul-de-sacs in their streets. And so we are truly trying to call this one a locals 4th of July, where we still have celebrations, but we celebrate locally.
So not putting on the parade and all of the park activities, the city is saving about $2 million, but it sounds like it's really a bigger hit just given the loss of economic activity. Do we have any idea what that would stand at on a normal year?
Well, I guess that runs the gamut. That $2 million number that you're alluding to, that would be the entire sort of event schedule throughout the season. That's for all sorts of events throughout the season, whether it's transit service, public safety services, pedestrian management, signage, putting out bollards, sanitation. That's the whole kind of kit and caboodle. But that's not, I don't think, what we're suggesting, nor do I, I'm going to speculate here, nor do I think where we'll end up. I think we'll come up with an abridged events calendar. We'll probably come up with some stringent regulations for the events that are allowed to continue. And some events will have to function very differently than they have in the past, and others may be canceled altogether. So that's why we're going to have this work session with our elected officials, take their temperature, meet with stakeholders, call in the experts from the Summit County Health Department, and try to make sure that we're making an informed approach moving forward, taking the best practices and best information and using that to make our decisions.
All right. And those events that you mentioned before, Miner's Day, Autumn Alof, Shot Ski, and Halloween, still to be determined then, huh?
That's correct. So that we're going to begin that conversation this Thursday. And we realize that As I said earlier in the conversation, there are all sorts of nonprofits and businesses and jobs that are associated with these events in our community. And so we think it's absolutely worthy of having this public forum and this public discussion. And I know that staff and city council absolutely want people's input. And that's why we've invited stakeholders. And we've been doing a little bit of extra outreach around town using social media and otherwise to make sure that people are aware of this conversation we're having.
All right. An update on the near-term transportation strategies for State Route 248. There's a draft cooperative agreement on a transit lane with Utah, and this is to build a westbound bus rapid transit lane there?
That's correct. So holistically, next year, beginning in spring of 21, we'll see a bunch of improvements on the 248 corridor. It includes line restriping, shoulder running, inbound lane, some signal prioritization, and then a host of pedestrian improvements for bus shelters and crosswalks and all sorts of other improvements. And this is all going to tie into eventually kind of the Queens Park and Ride at the junction of 248 and Highway 40. So beginning next spring, the community will have passed the phase of the significant level of infrastructure improvements that have taken place in that corridor with the tunnel and the water project underway now. And then we will come in, resurface the street, update the line painting, update the signal prioritization, make it safer for pedestrians, enhance crosswalks. There'll be a host of improvements associated with that. And one of them will be this inbound shoulder running bus lane, very similar to what folks are probably familiar with on 224.
So given that, with that, are we able to maintain bike lanes and a breakdown lane by adding that BRT lane?
Well, it's a good question. And in a lot of cities, those are used simultaneously. So they're used concurrently in that bicycles and buses can use the same lane if it's a segregated lane or a shoulder lane. But we're proposing, because of the rail trail, that we eliminate that shoulder running bike lane out on 248, because there's an alternative that's safer, and that's the rail trail. And we might be having a different conversation if we didn't have that safe alternative that was out of the right of way. So that will be an accommodation that will be necessary to run buses on the shoulders.
Yeah. What about the signal? When does that go in there at that Park City Heights intersection?
I believe that's also spring in 21. It may be this fall. I can't remember off the top of my head, but it is within, let's say, the next 12 months or so that betterment will be implemented.
All right. And it looked like, we had plans for a Quinn's Park and Ride. Are we moving forward with that, or are we now reconsidering maybe other locations for...
Well, we're doing both, to be honest. I think that there's a lot of planning and a lot of work that needs to be done, and UDOT needs to be involved. You know, our partner who kind of controls the property that we're evaluating for a park and ride, and will have to help us with easements on their highway to run elevated levels of service and transit priority. But particularly Council Member Steve Joyce and then all the city council supported that we would have to kind of run out the ball in exploring a few other parcels in that area. There was some concerns that the parcel that we had chosen, because it was free and quick and easy, because of the UDOT parcel right at the kind of juncture of 248 and 40, might not have been the best location, but clearly it was the cheapest, the most accessible, and the easiest to get quickly. But so a few of the council members said, well, there may be a couple other parcels out there that you want to explore. So we're doing that concurrently. Yet we're doing all of the planning for the corridor and the shoulder running lane. And the ultimate destination is something that we're going to come in and complete probably, I'd say, in the next 4 months.
Okay. Let's see. The council will also get an update on parking services. Are we talking about free parking in China Bridge and Main Street for the rest of the summer?
Well, perhaps. I think we're going to read the tea leaves on this one and work closely with our business district. And to be honest, we're going to follow the data. I think thus far, the parking department has utilized this down period to do a lot of preventative maintenance, work on graffiti, update signage, update their technology. So they will be flipping over and getting rid of the current mast or arms for entering China Bridge, and just utilizing the pay stations on Main Street in our garage. And for lack of a better word, we've had some You know, we've had some disgruntled customers late in the evening that are trying to get in and out of that garage that have damaged some of those arms and that infrastructure. And so we're taking that away. If people think it's an inconvenience and it's not customer service friendly, there are alternatives. So we've done that in this time period. But in terms of the long-term picture, you know, I think we're going to just try to be really responsive to the business district and follow the data. You know, on Sundays and otherwise, we've had roughly 50% occupancy in our garage and then approximately 70% occupancy on the street. And we're going to watch those numbers, and as they creep higher and higher, we're going to have to work with our business district to have a program that reflects, you know, the demand of parking. But right now, we are not charging.
Right. And so once we do go back to collecting money, I mean, how do we collect the money if there's no way to stop people from paying on their way out?
Well, the garage will just be signed like any other garage and will direct people to a pay station. So not unlike City Creek or when you go to the airport, there's enough signage to let you know that you're parking in either a garage or a public parking infrastructure and you need to pay the parking meter. And we'll have, you know, the various centralized parking meters throughout the garage. So that's something that our staff's been working on. They think it's going to be a customer service improvement. You know, right now we sort of had two systems and it was a little bifurcated. People were getting used to one system on Main Street and a different system in China Bridge. And that continuity wasn't working for the public, so we wanted to make an improvement.
Okay. Let's see. Federal CARES Act allocation, we're talking about $250,000 for Park City. Is this just the first allocation? How much more could there be?
It is. We hope there's two more, and we've currently been slotted for approximately $750,000. And so we received our first tranche, and our intent, and we're checking in with council, is to just apply this to the direct costs and expenditures that the organization has incurred as a result of COVID. And when I'm alluding to direct costs, I just mean personal protective equipment, sanitizer, masks, gloves, signage, sort of you name it, it runs the gamut. So we'll be applying this first tranche to those types of expenditures. And then we're hoping that there's two additional allocations from the federal government from here on out between today and let's say December.
And then what would you spend that money on?
Well, we've already have over, I think, gosh, almost $700,000 in expenditures. So if we receive a $750,000 allocation, I can't imagine between now and December that we wouldn't have another, you know, $50,000 to close that gap. So we could absolutely use every penny of it. And right now, our desire is all payroll costs and all direct expenditures related to COVID.
Okay. Hey, Matt, anything else you wanted to mention? I got to leave it there.
No, that's it. Thanks, Leslie. I appreciate it.
Thank you. That's Park City Manager Matt Dias. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. 8:46 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, after an abrupt early closing of the ski season in March, Deer Valley Resort ready to open for the summer season. On the phone to tell us what that's going to look like, I have Deer Valley Marketing Director Colleen Reardon. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So, of course, with the spike in COVID-19 cases, the resort's still planning to reopen. What's that going to look like?
You know, we have exhaustive plans in place to try and keep our staff and our guests safe. We're going to be physical distancing, in all of our lines and queues. We're also really encouraging our guests to wear masks, and our staff will all be required to wear masks. Taking reservations for things such as lessons and rentals in advance is really important. And then also purchasing a ticket in advance is important, too, because we are limiting visitation on the mountain, especially as it relates to mountain bikers. We think we may have to cut off mountain biking at times. We're pretty sure we won't have to, we don't know, but we're guessing that we won't have to limit scenic riders as much because they're easy to keep distant from each other. But we don't want the bike trails to get too crowded and have people backing up.
Right.
Or lines too long, you know, that the lift queue's too long. So we have our exhaustive plans are listed on our website because guests are really interested in knowing, you know, how we're going to operate safely. So you can visit there, and there's and in lodging, I shouldn't have left lodging out there. They probably have one of the larger plans because as it relates to cleaning the units and, you know, keeping them empty as long as they can between stays and those things. We're also putting plexiglass up between our staff members at points of sale and trying to go as touchless as possible. Jody Rogers, our F&B director, and her team are implementing the use of QR codes, which will be really cool for wait times at Royal Street Cafe as well as menus. Yeah, so we're really testing as much touchless and RT department payment features. So there's been a so much work going on behind the scenes to get ready for summer so we could safely open.
Yeah, it sounds like it's almost a practice for winter as well.
You know, for sure it will be. I think we'll have some great learnings. Our digital and web team in Altera are also researching solutions for us, too, that'll be, as far as reservation systems for summer, probably wouldn't be implemented in summer in time, but for next winter, all kinds of cool functionality being researched out there.
All right. So you mentioned selling online tickets. So people need to purchase those in advance, but what about those with season passes? I mean, you've often let them, use their pass as the ticket.
Yes, for sure.
Do they need to then RSVP or something, or how
does No, and that's what we're really working hard towards for winter. We don't think that'll be it. We have such a small number of summer season passes. We're not too concerned about that. We'll, like we do in the winter, we'll reserve a little access for them when we're counting for we have much information backing up from last summer in the RFID and using those gates. So we can pretty accurately predict, especially during busy periods and holiday weekends, how many season passes will show up. So that all will factor into if we call a sellout. Oh, we may have, 10 more season pass holders show up. So we reserve capacity for them. Next winter is still an unknown. We'll have to work through that as we learn more about the systems we're enabling.
Right. All right. So this Friday, is that the plan? What are the hours going to be then?
Yeah. So the plan is we opened up lodging June 1st, and then we went to the grocery cafe on the 5th. And I will say, whenever you go to grocery cafe, be prepared because we have limited seating in all of our restaurants, and so. You may be lucky enough to get a seat out on the deck, but, you might want to be prepared for takeaway, too. And then the Royal Street Cafe is opening with mountain biking. And then mountain biking opens, which is this Friday. And mountain biking is open from, I believe, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Yeah, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Okay, and that's
normal hours.
7 days a week.
Yeah, 7 days a week.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And then you'll also, you said, have rentals and lessons available.
Yes.
But
limited capacity on both of those, but we do have them available. So those we really encourage people to make advance reservations by calling our Gear Services Contact Center, because it's really important to get those on the books if you really want a lesson and or in need of a bike rental. So.
All right. I also saw some fishing lessons and stand-up boards there on the lake there outside the grocery cafe last night. So are you running those operations as well?
No, those aren't our operations. They're concessions. I do know that the paddle boarding operations began, I think 2 weeks ago. And then the fishing, I just heard from Steve Isowitz is starting up, but I believe that's a community program. So.
All right.
More on our website, too.
Yeah. What kind of hoops did you have to jump through then with the county health department to make all of this happen?
In the end, we didn't have to at all, but we were preparing as if we were going to, because it was such a great exercise, right? If we were going to have to submit the plans to the county for approval, that meant that we needed to be really thoughtful in our operating plans. And so every area, every business unit, submitted the plan. We found out a few days before that we weren't going to have to get county approvals, but we didn't take our foot off the gas. We acted as if we were going to need to do that. So really, that's where all the really hard work happened, was preparing those plans, because it's important for us to be safe for guests and our staff.
Sure. So were you able to bring back your entire summer workforce?
Not entire. It's a limited operation, so not entire. But we brought back quite a few staff, I think in the 100 to 150 range to get up and opening. But, it's not a normal summer, so we couldn't bring, sadly, everyone back on.
And so why is that? I mean, just because of the you're limiting restaurant patrons, or you're limiting, sales of lift tickets, things like that?
Yeah, it's all based on limited visitation and capacities, right? We aren't, it's not a normal summer. There's no concerts, no events. So that's a big chunk right there of our staff. So Royal Street Cafe is, I think the restaurants, and I might be guessing here, so I shouldn't, but I think we're about half capacity on all of our restaurants. So, it's just not business as usual.
Right. And while the snow park expansion was taken off the to-do mm-hmm. list this summer, is the resort working on other capital projects?
No, it's maintenance capital this year, and that's it, that's all. And we'll see what how next winter plays out. But it's really important for us to keep, you know, as many staff as we can employed, and also keep as many staff furloughed as we can that so they can still have benefits. And also, it's really important for us to, the financial health of this company is, you know, it's critical to not only Alterra and the individual resorts, but also to the communities we're in. So we've got to be mindful. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk just before before I end this. It's just, what about this winter? I mean, what do we know? You are selling lift season passes?
No, we aren't. We aren't. We're holding off selling. That's funny you should ask. We just talked about this the other day. We're holding off selling lift tickets, ski school reservations, and we'll be sending an email out about that probably next week. It's just too soon to know what it's going to look like, so we're uncomfortable selling or taking reservations until we know a little more. So the cadence on the sale and the reservations will be a little later than it normally is. But there's just so many unknowns. I mean, it's, you know, you make a decision, you back up, you make a different decision, right? So we don't want to compromise our guest experience or the experience we're able to provide by jumping the gun, you know, too quickly.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, I talked to Steve Isowitz, and you had mentioned something to me about the head frame, and I just wanted to, it was important for Steve to give a big shout-out to the Empire Pass Masters Association, because they were responsible for the upkeep of the historically significant items that are within the Flagstaff development, and they've really, Doug Ogilvie has really taken a lead on that piece, and he just felt like that was a shout-out that was due.
Yeah. Okay. This is the old mining structure that collapsed there.
Right.
It was part of the old Daily West mine. So
the Daily West head frame.
Yeah. So the resort, tell me about this. I mean, it was the head frame itself owned by the Jordanelle Special Services District, as well as the property underneath it?
Yeah. So it's kind of convoluted. The, you know, with the community desire to restore and preserve the historical nature of our community, there was the development agreement. When that land was purchased, wasn't very clear. So if you fast forward to where we are now, we purchased it. We're going to probably give it over to the city and perhaps another historical organization, and then there'll be a collective effort from the Empire Pass Owners Association and some other organizations to restore and preserve it. So. And there's a number of organizations that have, the city included, have committed monies to the fund to help perform that preservation. So,
okay. So for now, it'll just remain fenced and off limits. You kind of got a big
fence.
Yeah,
I guess so. I guess that's true because it isn't really safe there right now.
Yeah. Okay, Colleen, thanks
for
your
stable.
Right. Okay, well, thanks for your time this morning.
Okay, thank you, Leslie.
Colleen Reardon is the marketing director of Deer Valley Resort. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW News Time 856. It's 8:57. Good morning. Well, the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission hosted their first public hearing for the large Dakota Pacific proposal there at Kimball Junction. They heard from speakers mostly critical of the plan. A number of the comments urged the Planning Commission to recommend a denial. They argue the project will accelerate growth in the area and said that the county can do better with a large, important piece of property there at the entryway to Park City. About a dozen people spoke to the Planning Commission. They included two of the former county commissioners who in 2008 gave approval to the Boyer Company for an office park devoted to research and technical business. One of those, Bob Richer, noted that the Boyer approval preserved parcels of open space, kept 800 units from being spread across the hillside, and acquired land for the Kimball Junction Transit Center. Richer said while he is open to improvements on that legacy, the Dakota proposal with up to 1.3 million square feet of residential, office, and commercial highlights the type of uses that would only accelerate growth. Richard said the development has a high bar to comply with the Snyderville Code Provision 2.3, which says that the county cannot create new density unless it receives a compelling public benefit.
You're giving up leverage and control to solve two problems, but you're not solving the problems. You're accelerating development, which may lead to additional unforeseen problems and issues. This proposal is premature. It is not ripe. A no vote leads to more negotiation, and more negotiation could lead to a more elegant solution. You need to feel the magic. What you feel is a queasy sensation in your stomach because there is no magic here.
He urged the Planning Commission to be tough negotiators and to unanimously deny the project.
Think about what it will be like to drive by this project in 20 years with your now adult children in your car. Will you take pride in what you've done here, or will you be ashamed? I wish you the former, I fear the latter.
In other comments, Kathy Mears said the plan looks attractive, but this is a project for an expanding urban area, and Snyderville isn't that. She said a planned 1,100 residences in the project is not good news.
And this is being touted as a community benefit, and I have yet to encounter anyone who thinks 1,100 more units at Kimball Junction will be a community benefit, unless perhaps they don't understand the ramifications of 1,100 units that we all know people will get in their cars and drive. And that's not going to be 1,100 people. That's going to be 2,200 people, 3,300 people. How many children in the school district? Nobody's even talking about that.
Dakota Pacific had their supporters. Gordy Hall said that Utah's growing and Dakota's plan is the kind of transit-oriented project that will reduce traffic over time. Tim Anker said that they need to encourage the kind of business that will not be restricted to research and tech.
Dakota Pacific is proposing far less office space than is currently in titled in this project, but I think that losing the restrictions of research and technology would allow very legitimate businesses and companies with good paying jobs to come into the market, provide economic diversity for the citizens of our county.
The Snyderville Commission hearing was continued until July 28th.